So I wanted to thank you all for being here, each and every one of you, and also thank the Maine Humanities Council for including my voice in this and for organizing this very important gathering. More than ever before, we need to build communities of like-minded people who love fiction, who love books, and to come together and talk about books and talk about life, and so on and so forth. So thank you all. Thank you, Diane, for all you've done and all you do at the Council and for making today's meeting possible. So today's remarks would focus on, of course, the book, but also on the contentious issue of gender equality and equity in Islam. I am a Muslim. I was born a Muslim, and I am a Muslim. And I would also briefly talk about I would offer this kind of Islam 101, if you will. But more importantly, I'll talk about political Islam versus Islam as a religion. Because in the book we read about Muslim Brotherhood and who they are, and there's so much misinformation and about Muslim Brotherhood that I thought I would also touch on that and talk about Muslim Brotherhood and other parts of political Islam. But for the sake of time, you have to forgive me, I'm going to stick to generality more than really getting too specific on all these issues, because that would demand and deserve a much, much longer conversation. So, and also, if we have time, I may also talk about really the difference between cultural Islam and how culture can get mixed up with religion, and these two can be mistaken for one another by Westerners and non-Muslims alike. So let's start with the book. Naguib Mahfouz's Palace Walk, or as we call him in the Middle East, Najib Mahfouz. And the book, which is the Palace Walk in Arabic, is Bain al-Qasrain. So it's a very, very famous and well-read book. I mean, he became a well-known writer here only after he received the international recognition. But in fact, in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, he's been, as you can imagine, very famous. And one or two movies were made, two movies, in fact, based on the same book. One back many, many years ago, and then another one later, and both in Arabic and both made in Egypt. It's a book of fiction that some would say, it, in a poetic way, it describes the early 20th century Egypt. And a chaotic political time in the life of Egypt, and a country, a nation which is heir to this very ancient and fascinating country that we all are, people for centuries have been fascinated by the rich and the mystifying culture and tradition of Egypt. And as I was reading the book, it would remind me of the 1001 Night stories, also known as the Arabian Nights in this country. And because most of the stories in that book, in case you haven't read them, take place in Cairo. And all they seem to have a connection with the city Cairo, people in Cairo. So in many ways, I was reading the book Perhaps it was the flowery language, and though I must confess I could not read it in Arabic, so like the rest of you, I could only read it in English. My Arabic is not that good. I'm a Farsi speaker, in fact, but I can't read such good books in Arabic. My Arabic is very basic. So, but I could sense that the flowery language and the descriptions and the lyrical language that reminded me of 1001 Night Stories. And I have to tell you this, the book is written really, really well, I'm being told, in Arabic. The translation, I'm not so sure. There were some parts that I really had a difficult time. I don't know if you experienced that or when you get to read it. Don't give up, continue to read. So the story is set during this chaotic time of the Egyptian Revolution of 1919. I'm going to throw a lot of numbers at you today, So please forgive me for that. 1919 is one revolution, and then 1952, the other revolution. So in many ways, it's a historical account of the British occupation of Egypt and Sudan. Both back then were kind of one country. It happens after the revolutionary leader Saad Zarul and other members of his group are arrested and sent to exile by the British. It's important to talk about the political party that Saad Zarul was representing. This was WACT party. In English it means delegation, government delegation, and the reason for that name, that the party got that name, WAFD, is actually based on Saad Zarul's request. He wanted to send a delegation of Egyptian nationalists to Paris to participate in this conference, and also to travel to go to London to meet and make a case for the independence of Egypt. And of course, the request was rejected, and they did not get to go to Paris, nor to London, and instead they were arrested, and the leadership of the party was sent to Malta, an island, in exile. So that really explains that this is a nationalist party, and what they were asking for was, again, independence of Egypt and Sudan. Once the leadership of the party, the members along with Saad himself were arrested, the street demonstration started in Egypt. People poured into the streets. There were quite a few strikes, general strikes, and that started the revolution of 1999. And of course the British military responded harshly and violently, and at the end it resulted in the death of over 800 Egyptian civilians. And finally the delegation got to go later to Paris, but the sad part is that once they got to Paris, only to hear President Wilson withdraw of the United States, saying that he was supporting the British occupation of Egypt. So one of those really sad things that after this delegation, that the suffering they went through to make it to Paris, to make a case for themselves with the international community, they were let down by then US President Wilson. In 1920, the British reluctantly accepted the Egyptians' demand for independence, but it was really not a full independence. Egypt was started to be ruled by this very fragile, uneasy, and competing, in terms of interest, of a coalition of the king, in terms of the axis of power. It was the king, the British residency, and the party, WAFD party. And that continued for 30 years till the 1952 revolution by General Gamal Abdel Nasser, which the revolution then ended the kings and the British, and strangely, the party's rule over Egypt. In fact, the WAFD party was banned by Nasser in 1952. And once the Egyptian revolution of 1952 also called the free officers, you can hear me there, was started, not only the party was banned, but this new chapter in the Egyptian political life began. So let's stop talking about the politics of Egypt of then, we'll go back to that, and go back to the book. So the story takes place in a Cairo neighborhood, and strangely, it's very similar to the one where Mahfouz himself had grown up in around 1917, after the passing away of Hussein Kamal, the Sultan of Egypt. And Sultan Kamal had been this really figurehead of Egypt, yet he didn't have much power. because Egypt back then was part of the Ottoman Empire, the ancestors of the modern Turkey, the state of Turkey. And so, in reality, the British had been ruling over Egypt. And of course, once the First World War ended, and the empire, Ottoman Empire, the Muslim empire of then, the superpower of back, that era was defeated by the British and the French. Egypt went directly to the British. And this is a time that, this is very important to us in the Middle East, because by the end of the World War I, the boundaries of the Middle East were redrawn by the powers which won the war, namely the French and the British. So, for example, the Kurds, and I'm a Kurd, so this is more personal to me than others, I'm a Kurd from Iran, Kurds, to give an example, the Kurdish communities were divided between Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. And the modern states were born. Lebanon went to the French, Iraq went to the British. So we see that the entire Middle East, the entire region, as well as North Africa, were divided between these two superpowers. And so naturally, the taking over of Egypt caused some unrest and gave birth to the domestic nationalist movement, which had the goal of forcing the British to leave and hand over the control of Egypt to the Egyptians. So in many ways, the book, Palace Walk, is a historical and political book, and which gives a face, a human face, to the faceless Egyptians of that era. It also describes the chaotic period of occupation of an Arab and a Muslim country by a Western European / Christian empire. So any wonders that even in today's North Africa, today's Middle East, among other places, there's this distrust between the Western powers and the native populations, the communities who have called us lands home for centuries. So I can tell you that it's almost safe to say that most of the Muslim countries to this day are suffering from the trauma of being occupied and controlled by the Western powers. And the subjugation of these once proud nations and tribes, and including the fact that the Western powers were there to steal the natural resources of those land, still continues to this day to be a cause of conflict, mistrust, hostility, and a source of really sorrow, I would say, between this kind of two worlds. The clash of civilization, which we keep hearing about, can have its roots in that. So, and this is, by the way, is true about Somalia, which was ruled by the Italians, India before the birth of Pakistan and Bangladesh, which was ruled by the British, Indonesia by the Dutch, Lebanon by the French, Morocco by the French. And so the list, as you see, goes on and on. In many ways, Palace Walk is a universal story of a family living in Cairo. And its fictional characters include, of course, not one of our favorites. I guess many of you haven't read the book, but when you read it, you would remember my words, hopefully. The husband, the head of the household, Al Sayyid Ahmad Abdul Jawad, who's the successful shop owner, and his family. He's a very dark character, and very hard to love or admire. In fact, there were times that when I forgot that he was a made-up character, and I started to curse him bitterly. And for his treatment of his wife, Amina, and their children. And I must confess, as a fiction writer, I find pleasure in hurting and at times causing the untimely and ultimate death of the characters I don't like or I don't care for. And you see, in writing fiction, you get away with that. You can kill people without having to go to jail. I mean, it's hard work, but I got to tell you, that's one of the few pleasures you get. So if I was the writer, there would have been some kind of an accident at some point. So here, the dude, the central character in this well-written, but as I said, badly translated book, is a merciless tyrant. At home, he's this strict Muslim who forces his beliefs as unreasonable, and I must argue, as un-Islamic as they are, or they were, on his family. And outside of home, he's a different person. Talk about an unreliable character. He's a devoted friend to many, and boy, does he like his wine and women. I'm getting you ready. Those of you who haven't read the book yet, really, it's quite a treat. It's a fantastic book. And he does not get enough of those very un-Islamic vices. For he goes out every night on these adventures, chasing wine, and as some people would say in the West, chasing skirts. And with some singing mixed in and being really merry and laughter and happy till he comes home. Drunk, very late. But the family also includes Amina, his wife. The obedient, patient, pious, and annoyingly devoted wife. There are times when she says, do something. Poison him. No kidding. Because she's the second wife. I mean, all that, she's not even the first wife. And so she gets the reader's full sympathy. I mean, she gets all the sympathy and the praise. And she deserves it. But the fact that the whole story, the book begins with her, the very first page, the very first chapter, begins with her. And that's, in fact, quite unusual in Arab literature, in Arab modern literature, that a book begins with a woman. So it starts with her. That tells us from the very, very beginning that she has a significant role to play in this book, and she does. In fact, she survives the family. And I'm sorry, those of you haven't read it again. So, and while throughout the story we look for her to start to act, to be assertive and rebel against her indecent husband, she quietly and without a fight accepts her fate. But in the end, it's so she's the one who gets to survive, and she's the one who gets the love and respect without any fear. Respect of her children. There's a touching scene toward the end of the book that she has her afternoon coffee. This is a routine throughout the book that she gets to have this coffee hour with her children, and they get to discuss and talk, and they get to mock her, one of the sons. But she doesn't mind that. But the touching scene towards the end of the book that she's finally having this coffee with one son is really beautiful. Now, the question that seemed to nag every Westerner and non-Muslim reader. In fact, if you go and read the reviews of the readers of the book, not the professional reviews, people are getting mad, why is she being treated this way? And in fact, some of those readers, I was laughing to myself, but forgetting this was a fictional book. They thought this was non-fiction. How can she be treated like that by her husband? But that's exactly the story, the point of the story. The treatment of women in her time, in her culture, and to provoke us as a reader, and that's the job of a good fiction. So So the nagging question that every Westerner and non-Muslim reader seems to have, and I had it as a Muslim, that is her husband, is her treatment is in accordance with teachings of Islam? Is her husband being a good Muslim by when he keeps her confined inside, mistreats her while he goes out on his nightly adventures? Is her plight shared by all or most or some Muslim women living in Egypt back then, in modern Egypt now, or elsewhere? So these were some of the questions that I had that I want to touch on. And the treatment of women by men in Islam, and if you pay attention, I'm not saying by Muslim men, by men in Islam, because to me, we can't call them Muslim men. If they're treating their spouses, their daughters, their mothers, their sisters that way, I don't want to call them even Muslims. So I don't believe that the treatment of women by men in Islam has anything to do with teachings of Islam. And I'm encouraging you to ask me questions later so I can talk more about it if needed. But I would say that it's really more of a function of the culture, the political system of the land, the tradition of the tribe, the land, the community. There are other factors, such as class, where the woman lives, in urban versus the rural parts of that country, that land. And tradition again and again. For example, in parts of Africa, we will see that Muslim women behave and do things the same way that the Christian African women do the same. So that tells us that this, rather than being a Christian or a Muslim tradition, it has to be an African or a tribal tradition. And that goes from honor killings, yes, some Christian communities in parts of Africa, in Pakistan, have the honor killings just as their Muslim neighbors do. So that again tells us, if you were to be non-biased and non-judgmental and really look for facts, that this kind of behaviors perhaps have the roots in the cultural and what I call outdated traditional practices or the cultures of the land. So whether it's the covering of the hair, which a Hindu woman would do in South India, while a Muslim woman would do it, it could be about, again, the culture and the tradition of the land. There's also the point of the men have managed to hijack the religion and acting as middlemen between the creator, the God, and the worshippers. So are millions of Muslim women in Muslim societies experiencing oppression? Of course, absolutely. Is it everywhere and common to every Muslim country? No. Is it the fault of Islam as a religion? Not at all. And again, I would offer some historical examples and verses to back my points. To give an example, I go and talk about Islam, as you can imagine, and I teach Islam and culture of Islam and women in Islam. In fact, my play is about women in Islam. That's why I decided to write that. For many years, I waited for a Muslim woman to write the book. And no one did, so I finally did. And I have that disclaimer everywhere I go that I'm sorry, wrong gender. This should have really been told by women, but no one volunteered, and I did. And now I know it's a lot of work. So I talk about Islam, and I keep being challenged that, well, why can't Muslim be allowed to drive? And then I have to come back with this question that there are 57 countries which are either all Muslims or Muslim majorities, 57 countries. Only in one single country, Saudi Arabia, women are not allowed to drive. Oh. In Tunisia, in Iran, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Turkey, in Albania, Bosnia, Malaysia, women are actually taxi drivers. They are public bus drivers, and they have been so for many, many, many years. So it's really important to be mindful of that, that what we hear about the treatment, the harsh treatment, and ugly, treatment of women as second-class citizens in Saudi Arabia does not represent the universal picture. It does not tell us that women are treated like that in every single country. So the treatment of women vary. And if you were to look at the continuum in terms of which country women have enjoyed the most rights and which country the worst, Saudi Arabia would be in one. And the other end, it could be Indonesia, it could be Malaysia, it could be Tunisia, Morocco, and a few other countries. So, and in between, there are all these countries that would fall again, depending on the political system, the current political system. Women in Iran prior to 1979 enjoyed lots of rights. And in the 60s, we had women who were part of the parliament, the first minister, the first woman minister. And then the 1979 revolution happens, the so-called Islamic revolution, and most of those rights were removed, were taken away by the government. But the women in Iran are fighting back and gaining some of their rights back to the extent that we had a woman vice president in Iran a few years ago, that in Iran, over 50% of the student body in colleges and universities happen to be women, that there are more women PhD candidates in Iran. And this is important because Iran is being ruled by some really strange fundamentalist Shia Ayatollahs. So you would imagine that women in Iran have been pushed to the margins, and silenced, and put behind walls, absent from the public square. But in fact, they've been fighting back, the women have been fighting back and gaining their rights back. So Islam, right from its birth, some 1400 years ago, was the first religion, the first Abrahamic religion, some would say, that stated that women and men are equal. And the statement to support that came in the holy book itself, in black and white, that there is a surah and a chapter in the holy book, which states, it's Surah Al-Nisa, it states, and I quote, men and women are created from a single soul. Men and women are created from a single soul. Nafsa wahida in Arabic, meaning one soul. And I find that so beautiful because it doesn't say that one is superior to another, one doesn't say one came before, and that a woman is not created for the sake of serving a man's needs or pleasure, rather they're both created for the mutual benefit of one another. And again, men and women are created from a single soul. Also in practice, Islam expects and requires men and women to do everything that the religion is asking them. So if daily prayers is required of men 5 times a day, the same thing is required of women 5 times a day. If going to Mecca, the annual pilgrimage, is required and expected of every able-bodied and financially capable Muslim, the same thing is asked of women. So when it comes to praying, reciting, visiting the mosque, paying charity, going to Hajj, the men and women are again required to do the same thing exactly. And that tells me that that the teaching, the original teachings of the religion was quite revolutionary for its time 1400 years ago. Now what happened between then and now, I go back, I just said that men have managed to hijack religions, and so some of that has happened to Islam as well. And so rather than the fault of Islam, it's the fault of lousy Muslim men. So, and to compare, I mean, let's put this in historic perspective. We're talking about 1400 years ago. To compare in the West, in England, it's the end of 19th century and the early 20th century where women are allowed to receive inheritance. Prior to that, the inheritance they would bring to the marriage would automatically go to the husbands. Where Islam, the right to inheritance, the right to marry, the right to divorce, the right to start your own business, started with the religion itself. In other words, there was no reform. The women did not have to fight to get those rights. And that was given to them. That I would say the Prophet himself was the feminist. He was a feminist in closet because he religion starts, and right from the beginning, it starts with saying men and women are equal and in practice. So, for example, another historic example in Islam, it's very interesting. In Islam, the whole issue of Adam and Eve is not blamed for the fall of Adam. Islam puts the blame equally in both of them. Now that's fascinating. It was years ago when I came across that and I thought, how many Muslims know about that? Never mind about non-Muslims. And I included it in my play, so there's actually one of the characters says, well, I was shocked to find that out. And that was me, in reality. When I found that, I had to check that with quite a few scholars and said, am I reading this right? That Islam says the fall of so-called man was not caused by, it's the same story by the way, snake, apple, all that. But it's not Eve who seduces Adam. And so for that reason, Muslim women have never been blamed, I mean, centuries later, they have never been blamed to be the cause for the fall of man and all the problems. So. And again, I can go on and on, give other examples, and let's talk about marriage in Islam. Unlike the ancient Christian concept of marriage until death, in Islam, right from the beginning again, marriage has been looked at as a contract between two adults. In fact, that's why they need witnesses, like any other legal contract, that you go to a law office and you may need some witnesses and that marriage in Islam is seen as a social and legal contract with the rights of both parties defined in the beginning. So as with every contract, both parties have to be willing to be part of it. So in Islam, when two get married during the religious ceremony, the bride and bridegroom is asked by the imam and says, are you willingly getting into this marriage? And the woman has to say not once, not twice, three times, she has to be heard. She has to articulate that this is of her. She's getting married willingly, no one is forcing her. Now, is that the case in most Muslim countries as we speak? Of course not. We have the whole issue of child bride in many, many Muslim countries. But the child bride is, I would argue, is really a function of poverty. And again, back to outdated traditional system than religion. Child bride is not confined to the Muslim world. I wish it was. We could have dealt with it easily. Sadly, it's common to many, many cultures and many parts of the world. So again, by saying all these things, I'm not suggesting that these are being followed by all Muslims. Absolutely not. So in that contract, for example, the man agrees to pay the damage should he turn out to be really a bad husband, and that that amount of money that they would agree, both parties would agree, is called mehr. And sometimes that negotiation takes days, sometimes months, sometimes years. The bride family would say, well, we don't trust this guy, so we need to have this insurance that he would come up with money, property, gold, cows, camels, cars, in today's world. So again, and again, according to the laws of Islam, when it comes to marriage, one would end a contract and by the act of divorce. So another example would be education. Education from the beginning of this young Abrahamic religion was really one of the core values of the whole religion. And for that reason, both men and women were required to educate themselves. Self-improvement is important in Islam. So, and again, 1400 years ago, Islam did not say men should only educate themselves, good luck with half of the population. But in fact, the Prophet, we have a saying from the Prophet directly that gaining knowledge is a duty of every Muslim man and woman, end of quote. Meaning again, that the Prophet practiced that. He married a woman who was independent business owner, Khadija, his first wife, who was older than him, and she was the one who proposed marriage to him. Muhammad, being a wise man, accepted that, because then later on she became his mentor. So his own wife was an independent business owner. And I go out of my way to emphasize on this, because this is the same religion that now you have the Taliban coming 1400 years later and saying women should not work outside of home. So I gotta tell you, as a Muslim, I am confused. I don't know about you guys. Because I'm thinking, if the Prophet himself had his own wife 1400 years ago, run a business, what is the problem for a woman to be in, run her own business in today's Afghanistan? Let's briefly talk about hijab before we go back to the book. So hijab is a sign of modesty in Islam. It is not a requirement that women cover themselves from head to toe and resembling what I sometimes say, forgive me for being so harsh, as a potato bag. That's not. It's a sign of modesty. And by the way, both men and women in Islam are required to observe that modesty. And I can tell you, some of you as practicing Christians or non-practicing Christian could remember your own parents or grandparents who would wear a scarf when entering a church. It was really a sign of respect. You wanted to show respect when you were in the house of God, so to speak. So really modesty is about that, where that men and women both should show modesty. So I searched the holy book of Quran looking for verses which says, cover your head, cover every part of your skin, don't show a part of your leg, don't show any strand of hair. I am yet to find any. The verse that I find is the Surah 24:30, which says, and I quote, and tell the believing women to lower the gaze, to draw the head covers over the chest, end of quote. So it's lowering the gaze and covering the hair or chest as a sign of modesty when in presence of male unrelated to them, or in other words, in public, is totally, I would argue, different than forcing women, as we see in so many Muslim countries today, to cover themselves and be confined to their home and not allowed to go to school or not to work. In other words, not to be able to rob them of their human dignity. Furthermore, in that same holy book, we are instructed men and women to guard their modesty, end of quote. Another one, display their beauty and ornaments, but to draw the veils, end of quote. And veil, 1400 years ago, they're talking about veils, we weren't there. We don't know what they meant. The definition of well can be really end of your, part of your dress, or if you're wearing a sari, as Muslims do in India, the end part of a sari, or part of the scarf or shawl. I don't think they meant what we see again in the Taliban era, Afghanistan, or in lands which are controlled by ISIS in today's Syria, or rural parts of Pakistan, where again women are forced to cover themselves completely and in a really strange way. So, and again, I can go on talking more about women in Islam, but perhaps we'll get a chance to talk more about it. So the treatment of women in the Muslim world is not really one size fits all. It varies from country to country. It varies from time to time. I encourage you to go home when you get a chance and do a quick Google search. Type women in Afghanistan in the 60s. Women in Afghanistan in the 70s. You would come across black and white pictures of young women outside of Kabul University. This is prior to the invasion of Afghanistan by the Red Army, by the Russians in 1979. And so that's Afghanistan of the mid-70s, early 70s, late 60s. And yes, in some of those pictures, street scenes, you see some women who are covering their hair and covering their bodies. But there's a diversity in covering themselves. Not all of them would look alike. And then do the same thing Afghanistan during the Taliban, and you will see every single woman is being covered. So my question would be, were Afghans bad Muslims prior to the invasion of their country by the Russians? And then during the Taliban era, they became better Muslims? I don't think so. I think they were Muslims. I think the same way, I think what changed were the men in power, the political system of the land, the country being invaded, and there are tons of reasons that some Afghan nationalists would give you why that change happened. And part of it being that there are stories of drunk Russian soldiers. They're invaders, they're occupiers. This book we're talking about is about occupation. They were going around looking for beautiful Afghan women to rape. So the elders in the community said, let's cover ourselves. Now, I believe that's part of it. I think there were other factors in play. So all that to say that the Western non-Muslim reader is reading this book and gets teary-eyed for Amina and feels sorry and imagines that all Amina and Amina's sisters in other parts of the Muslim world are being treated that way, and the end result, he or she, the reader, gets upset and angry with Islam. So one more person who hates Islam. But if Amina is being treated that badly by her husband, let's remember that the husband also treats the daughters, the beautiful Aisha and the sharp-tongued Khadija, also harshly. And so they too are the victims here. Except in their case, they have this escape clause. It's called marriage. So as we read the book, we come across this. They have this hope of getting married and getting out of this abusive situation. But as wise readers as we are, we know there's a danger in that, because they make it from one bad situation to another. There is no guarantee that the husband would not be worse than the father. So it's again, what is so rich about this book, this story as it unfolds, that you start worrying about these daughters, and that who are they going to get married? Would Aisha be treated gently by whoever she gets to marry? Would that be a love marriage? Well, you have to read the book for that. And let's talk about the sons. Yasin, the stepson, a public servant, a government servant who seems to share his father's appetite for women and wine. And Fahmi, the second son, who's politically involved, is a law student and a nationalist, a proud Egyptian, and Kamal, the youngest of the family. And Kamal seems to love everyone in the family. And later on I talk about how I think that each of them might be a metaphor for the Egyptian society of back then. And the Al-Jawad households, the struggles, their personal suffering, the self-doubts, their dysfunctional lifestyle, strangely seem to mirror that of the Egyptian society where they live. And there are parallels between the lives of the family, members of Al-Jawad family, and that of the nation. Here we have a nation, once a very proud nation, and the heartland of the Arab world and the Muslim world. And in the years to follow, will once again retain its greatness in the Arab world and Islamic world, by extension, by becoming, a cultural heart of Islam. What do I mean by that? Egypt houses one of the most important Islamic universities in the world, Al-Azhar University, the oldest and nicest. And what people think in Egypt, other Arabs follow. Books get published in Egypt. Films get made. Iran and Egypt were the only two countries, and I think that they continue to be the only two countries, now added, Israel is added, in the Middle East, which have very vibrant film, local film industry. Iranians and Egyptians make good films. Except the Egyptians really make, the films are mostly for the Arab world, and Iranian films seem to be doing well, quite well internationally. So that's Egypt for you. And then you see this nation, proud nation, being humiliated by the British Empire, the superpower, and made to feel weak and robbed of its national dignity. So the story also takes place during a time when the Egyptians are feeling the tension, the tone between modernity and tradition. And they are torn between the seduction of secularism and the strict laws of Islam. And that's similar between them, by the way, between the Egyptians and other Muslims of that era elsewhere in North Africa and in the rest of the Muslim world, I would say, even in Asia, that Muslims went through this period of time that they felt this tension. They wanted to be modern. They had just been exposed to the West thanks to the colonial powers and the occupations. And so they liked what they were hearing. They liked that there was free thinking and people could read any books they wanted, and art was important, not that art wasn't important in Islam. But they liked what they saw, and they were torn between, again, modernity and the old tradition. And the old tradition being things that had come with the land, which again had got mixed up with the religion. Earlier I talked about how cultures and religions tend to mix. This is a great example. That number of things that Muslims do might not have anything to do with Islam. It's a cultural thing that generation to generation was transferred. So my young Somali student would come to my office and would argue with me that what she does is Islamic. And I have to sit there and be patient to explain to her that actually what we're talking about in that particular case, what she's doing, is very, very tribal, very, very Somali, and very, very African. That I, as a Muslim growing up in the Middle East, have never heard of that practice, for example. So again, as Muslims and non-Muslims, we all get confused what is culture, what is religion, and it's hard to really separate them as two. They've lived together, they've become mixed, and all that. So Egyptians are torn between their Muslimness, their Arabness, and yet this pool of, the strong pool of the Western style modernity that offers possibilities. And in the early 20th century Egyptian society, just as in Iran, where I was born, or neighboring Iraq or Turkey, younger people look at the Western education system. We like what we saw, the advancement in technology, in science, and we saw that, we looked at that with envy. And such progress, we imagine, would not be possible within Islam, and living as a pious Muslim, because we had forgotten our own history, that it was Islam that actually liberated science, liberated books, that it was Islam that encouraged early Muslims to get into critical thinking, to question things. It was early Islam that really made it possible for Jewish philosophers, Christian monks, Muslim scholars, Hindu mathematicians, and Buddhists, and Arabs, Persians, Turks, to get together, and Romans, Greeks, to get together and work together and translate each other's work to Arabic or Hebrew. And in the process, lay the foundation of the Renaissance, which would happen later in Europe. Now, as a younger generation, we've forgotten that it was our religion that actually named the stars. That we invented chemistry, algebra, itself an Arabic word, zero, itself an Arabic word. Because what we had come to look at Islam was this very, really, a non-scientific religion that only rituals and asked you to do this and you would go to hell or heaven. So we looked at the West with envy, and that's a tension that I was talking about. And of course that changes once we get to the late 1970s and early 80s, when what we call the revival of Islam, that is this new Islam that says science and technology is part of the religion. And then we see ISIS, we see Al-Qaeda using social media for their evil reasons. But you don't see ISIS saying science is bad. They're actually using science for their to reach their own horrible goals. So in the book, the family dynamic is very universal. A mother who continues to make sacrifices to keep her home running, and the husband who goes out to drink and have sex outside of marriage, which by the way both are forbidden by Islam, and the three sons and two daughters who tease each other, tease the mother, mock one another. So in many ways the Al-Jawad family could have been an American family in the 1950s. It's that universal, except in the case of the American family, the husband would have sat at home, watched the TV, and had a few beers. And he might have been abusive physically or not. So really, other than those few details, we see that's the universality of this family. And I might be overthinking this, but the three sons each could be a metaphor for different periods of modern Egyptian history. What do I mean by that? I keep thinking that Yasin, the stepson, and the government center might be representing the traditional Cairo, the old Cairo. And Fahmy, on the other hand, the restless and politically active, could be the restlessness of a nation occupied by foreigners, dreaming of independence and self-determination. And of course, the youngest one, Kamal, he could be representing the possibilities of hope, of a brighter future for his nation. So, how are we doing with time?
About 10 minutes.
Listen. Oh, thank you. Reading this book is again important for us as Americans, because we live at a time when we have American armed forces, who have either occupied Muslim countries, at least two, or are there fighting for this nation. So this book actually helps us to look at the suffering of people who are being occupied, of what they go through, and also that how misleading it could be to think that the people who are occupied are kind of okay with that. because they could really act as if they're they're okay, but they are. We know, thanks to this book, that they actually they honor those who fight the occupiers and dismiss and are disgusted by those who collaborate with the occupiers. So the book is really is about it gives us a chance to look at the ugliness of occupation and how those who are being occupied can look at the occupying powers as and not forgiving them for centuries and for a long, long time to come. So let's see what else we can talk about so we know the book is about a family facing daily challenges, but we also know that it's a story of a restless nation and searching for and dreaming of its glorious past and searching for the possibilities. It's a story of a generation of Egyptian waking up from a long nap to seek liberty, dignity, and be free of foreign interferences. So it's universal in the sense that the story, the book would have happened in Iran, in Syria, in Turkey, India, Morocco, or even in Africa, in a country such as South Africa. We all know, for example, the bloody struggle of the Moroccan, the Algerians had to experience when they sought the independence from the French. It was a long war. Hundreds of thousands of Algerians were murdered. So it makes me sad to hear that sometimes I hear that Muslims, Africans, brown people, they don't know how to practice democracy. That something in their religion, something in their culture really stops them from democracy. This book is a shining example of how when people such as Egyptians, Iranians of the Mossadegh era in 1953, they tried to practice democracy, and what they received in return was violence. Their leaders were arrested, were murdered, were killed, were put in prisons. So examples after examples of that, perhaps it's not Muslims. It has nothing to do with the religion and democracy. It's just that they were never given the chance. Every time they tried, and throughout the history we come across in many of these countries, that any time they tried to practice democracy and wanted to be free, they were not given the chance. Briefly, I want to talk about Muslim Brotherhood and then I will stop for question and answer. Because Muslim Brotherhood plays a role here. And you see, the Waft party is very, very active. And then there's this competing party, the Muslim Brotherhood. So who are they? And Muslim Brotherhood, or the Society of Muslim Brothers, or there are different versions of that. For short, they're called in Arabic, they're called Al-Akhawan al-Muslimin, Muslim Brotherhood, is a transnational Sunni Islamist organization which was actually founded in Egypt in 1928. So Muslim Brotherhood was born in Egypt, and now it has a presence in about 10, 15 other Muslim countries. And according to many countries, it's a terrorist organization. But over the years, it started as a political party. It became violent. It went back to become a political party. It became an organization that did a lot of good charity work in the countries where it was present, and then it went back to being banned as a terrorist group. So the organization is very well known and has gained supporters in the Arab world, in particular during the Arab Spring movement of the early 2000s. It has influenced other Islamist groups such as Hamas, the Palestinian group, and Hezbollah by some extent, except Hezbollah is a Shia Islamist group, and Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood, is a Sunni transnational, very important, because is Sunnis and Shias don't get along. And Muslim Brotherhood is unique that its model of political activity is mixed with charity work. So it wherever Muslim Brotherhood has been active, they've offered free hospitals, free healthcare, schools, food centers, orphanage centers, clinics, childcare. And this could explain their popularity, because I have friends who say, how can a terrorist group be so popular? What's wrong with Muslims in that country? Because when Muslim Brotherhood goes to participate in election, they actually do quite well. Same thing is true with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah is now a political party, and they are part of the coalition government in Lebanon. And to many, many Westerners, that sounds strange, that Hamas, which is a terrorist group according to us, and I would say it has been behind many, many atrocities and terror, Muslim Brotherhood, yet they get votes. This could explain the popularity, that they actually run, they do very well with charity work. So Muslim Brotherhood was started in Egypt, and then it was banned in 1952 by the socialist who came to power, Jamal Abdel Nasser. And once that revolution happened, Jamal Abdel Nasser, who was also a nationalist but touching on socialism, banned Muslim Brotherhood. He had no place in his world for anything religious. In the 1970s, once Nasser died and Anwar Sadat came to power, Muslim Brotherhood was invited back to Egypt as a leadership and allowed to participate in Egyptian politics. Finally, Muslim Brotherhood did really well in the revolution against Hosni Mubarak, the dictator of Egypt, in 2011 as part of the Arab Spring. We all watched as large crowds of young people, Egyptians, Christians, Muslims, Coptic Christians, and other minorities coming together as Egyptian, demanding the overthrowing of Hosni Mubarak. And once in 2012, a year later, when there was a national election, presidential election in Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood did extremely well, so well that in fact Mohamed Morsi became the president, and then there was another revolution, because some Egyptians found out that Mohamed Morsi was too extreme for the society of Egypt, and they were concerned about the rights of religious minorities, other minorities, and now we have a general in power, the generals in power. I'm going to stop here and see if you have any questions. And I'm sorry if I didn't get to talk more about Islam, but hopefully in future, in other opportunities, or we can ask me questions and we talk about Islam in general. Please.
How is it that all this Muslims all over the world annually, with all the diversities, cultural differences, come together for the Hajj?
Yes. Well, because it's a requirement of Islam. Islam has five pillars. One is the daily prayer. One is fasting during the month of Ramadan. The third one is testifying that there's only one God and only God. And then charity, and then finally the annual pilgrimage. So it's a requirement, and as a requirement it stands above politics of the time. And once a year, millions of Muslims, I think the latest number can be 2 million, gather in the spiritual magnet of Islam, in the birthplace of this Abrahamic religion, to gather it's a reenactment of the Day of Judgment, basically. And so they can do that because it's required by the religion, and they can set aside the differences and manage to go there and for a few days sound united, look united. Hajj is an amazing experience, this massive movement of humanity across borders, not to go to war with one another, but to come to go and pay, to worship the house that Muslims believe was built by Abraham and son, is amazing. So they go there and again, it's a miracle that this practice has been happening uninterrupted since the birth of the religion, despite the world wars, the conflicts, that Muslims managed to do that. It is, many Muslims don't like that it's the Saudi Arabian government that controls this important, the most important site for our religion, but we have no choice. And you go there and Muslims know that by doing so they're making the Saudis richer. 2 million people going there and spending 10, 15 days. And so I hope that answers your question, that somehow it happens. That I think part, the bigger part is because it's an important requirement. It's one of the five pillars. It's not by choice. So Shia, Sunni, Sufis, good Muslims, bad Muslims. I mean, you're supposed to be a good Muslim if you go there. Men and women, by the way. So it's again, women are required to go. And they go there and they spend time. Please.
I'm not sure what kind of education that the mother, Mina, and the daughters had. And did they read? Did they read the Quran? Because the mother's always quoting it to the little boy.
Could they read?
Yeah. Were they able to read?
I don't know. I had that question, and I want to say that I have to go back and read it. But I want to say that they could read the holy book, but not read and write. Otherwise, they were illiterate. So they knew some basic. They could read the holy book, the mother, Amina. Because the daughters, you're right, were removed from the school by the abusive father, which was a practice, it seems, back then in Egypt. In 1917, when the book happens, not in all Muslim countries, in some Muslim countries, young girls would not be allowed to continue. In other countries, they, my sister in Iran, my sister who's in her 90s, was studying French. And her younger sisters, which would be the 30s or 40s, my sister, but younger than her, went to college, and my father made sure that boys and girls all went to college. So again, it went from one country to another. But in Egypt, it seemed that was the tradition, that girls beyond the first 4 or 5 years, they would not continue. So the mother, if possible, could not read and write. The daughters, I think, could read and write. But it's good, another excuse to read the book. Please.
I wonder if you'd comment on the tension that exists within the holy book between violence and peace. Those that say, you know, Islam is a religion that supports violence, and those that say it really supports peace.
In my reading of the holy book, it's like any other holy scripture, that the language is very, very weak, that two of us can read the same verse and walk away with different meanings. Reza Aslan, who's this famous, well-known Muslim scholar, and if you haven't read any of his books, he's written some good books about Islam, has a saying that I really like to repeat, that no religion is violent or peaceful. It's what you take to the religion. So if you're a violent person, you're a Muslim, your version of Islam is violent. If you're a peaceful Christian, your version of Christianity is peaceful. So he says it's wrong to think that this religion is peaceful, this religion is violent. It's individuals, so communities. And they take their own baggage to the religion and then say, but it's my religion. They hide behind the religion. But in Islam, the holy book has a few verses in black and white, very clear. And the one I want to share with you tonight is that you kill one person, you've killed the entire humanity. You save one, you've saved the entire humanity. Now, to me, that's so clear. That if you kill one, imagine. Now, which part of that the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Taliban doesn't understand is beyond me. They claim to be Muslim, but I like to think of them as criminals for hijacking my peaceful religion to reach their own political goals. Because which part of this verse is, this is not ambiguous. It says, you kill one, you've killed the entire humanity. Now, we have terrorists to go and plant a bomb in a marketplace, in a mosque, and kill innocents, women and children. So I like to think that what they do is really, is the terrorists are criminals, and they just happen to claim that they're doing it in the name of Islam. So Islam has many verses, yet, I want to be fair, there are people who would challenge me and say, but there are verses in Islam which says, well, kill this, do that. Yes, but I like to think that these verses were given for a particular time and place. So when the religion was under attack, when it was born 1400 years ago, you can imagine there were some powerful enemies who did not want this religion to last and to grow. So the religion, as a young, the Islamic religion, it was under such tremendous, it was a risk to the extent that the Prophet had to escape. He became a refugee. And one of the early refugees in our shared common Judaism and Christianity and Islamic tradition, we all have had refugees, Moses and Hajar. And Muhammad is one of them, that he also became a refugee in his own lifetime. He had to escape to go to Medina to seek safety. A Jewish tribe basically gave him protection. So some of those verses, which tend to be violent, we think are really for that time and place in history, when the religion was under attack. And so it says, yes. But even in those verses, it says, defend yourself. If your enemy puts down the arm, you need to do the same thing. Don't harm the crops. Don't cut trees. I mean, such clear instructions about not causing harm. And then you have people who hijack a plane and use it as a weapon to kill thousands of people. So.
Can you postulate what might happen in Egypt, you know, in years to come? I mean, now they've got the general ruling.
Well, from my readings, and I love the Egyptian political scene. Egypt was also home tonight. I didn't get a chance to talk about it. And there's no mention of that in the book, I'm surprised. Egypt was also home, not now anymore, to the oldest communist party in the Middle East, right? Yeah. Yeah, the Communist Party, pro-Moscow Communist Party, was very active in the politics of Egypt. So Egyptians have always been politically very active, very aware, very mobilized as a nation. So I don't think this is the end of the story.
Right.
And it's sad to see the U.S. government supporting the Arab, the generals. I don't think they're really good people. We should encourage Egyptians to go back to having an elected representative government. They tried their hand, and it's really sad that they got a man who sounded good. I'm talking about the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mohamed Morsi, who sounded good. I mean, but his policies, right from the beginning, he started to go to the other way. He started to forming very close relationship with the fundamentalist regime in Tehran and winking at Hamas and other extremist groups. And part of it is because it's his own political party, Muslim Brotherhood, had been a partner in all these groups. And that really, the Egyptians did not like that for good reasons. Coptic Christians were very, very, very concerned whether they had a future in Egypt under Mohammed Morsi. So again, young people poured into the Tahrir Square once again, but the outcome is not really what many of us had hoped for. So there's more to see. And these are countries which they have a very, very old history. For them, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, these countries have been around for thousands of years, and in one form or another. So what happens like in between 2015 and 2030 for them is really one page in the history. Because we're such a young nation, only 250 years old.
Yeah.
So there's more to see in Egypt, and hopefully it will be for better. They won't go the way Syria went.
Thank you.
Reza, thank you so much.
Thank you.